Lone Pine, California, September 6th, 1971. It is my thought to produce an extended commentary concerning the mandala, which consists of two conjugate equilateral hyperbolas with a square and a circle inscribed within it, and a second square inscribed within the circle. This discussion will consist of four parts. First, a consideration of the circumstances or occasion which led to its development. Second, a discussion of the correlation of mathematics in connection with religious orientations and philosophic orientations in general. Third, a discussion of the mathematics of the hyperbola. And fourth, an interpretation of its derived significance. Part 1. It was either during the latter part of July or the early part of August 1936 when I was standing on the bank of a creek in Northern California, and as I remember, was looking at the sky, when it suddenly dawned upon me that an error which is very common, in fact universal, is that of regarding the objects which stand before consciousness as being substantial. And it also dawned upon me that there where there seemed to be no objects whatsoever was actually a fullness, a substance. And that with respect to this substance, the objects which arrested the attention of consciousness were actually emptiness, or rather, relative emptiness. For I saw very clearly that there is a difference between the objects that stand before our consciousness, that some are indeed very dense, some make a strong impact upon us, and others are so subtle that they are almost impossible to apprehend, and that therefore it was not a simple case of stepping from a zone of objects arresting attention in one step to a zone of no objects whatsoever, but rather that there was a gradation between the state of objects and the state of the absence of objects. This formulated itself in my mind in the following way, therefore, that substance, the real durable substance which is the stuff of the universe, is there, where nothing arrests our consciousness as being an object. And on the contrary, these that seemed to be objects before consciousness were actually voids. Possibly it was the influence of Sir Isaac Newton which led to the formulation. Substantiality is inversely proportional to ponderability. For it sounds a good deal like Sir Isaac Newton's formulation of the inverse square law of gravity. This statement very soon appeared to me as essentially a mathematical statement. And I very promptly formulated it in mathematical terms. And that was this following statement. S representing substantiality equals 1 over P, P representing ponderability. Now, by ponderability, I mean that which produces an effect upon consciousness in the form of being an object that can be cognized specifically, can be measured, can be defined by a group of conceptions. It is, in other words, the measurable. But measurability or conceivability is here understood as an absence of substance. Substance being that which is inconceivable when it is taken in its purity. But as the principle of progression was clearly present in my mind, that there was not simply one fell step from an absolute ponderability to an absolute substantiality, I formulated it in the form which I have described, which implies the principle of the continuum and the principle of limits, as will be made clear in the part dealing with the theoretical mathematical aspect of this mandala. This impressed me as a very illuminating insight. I had not known at the time that there was any statement similar to this to be found anywhere. Yet later, in fact, quite recently, when reading The Voice of the Silence, which had been a book that I'd given great attention to over many years, one sentence stood out that served as a very important confirmation of my formulation. It is a sentence which is to be found on page 59 of The Voice of the Silence, the edition of 1889, and published by the Alliance Publishing Company of New York, and is in the middle of the first paragraph appearing on the said page 59. And the sentence is this: thou hast to study the voidness of the seeming full and the fullness of the seeming void. End of quotation. A thought has just come to me, which I wish to put down before I lose it. So let us introduce it here as a sort of extended parenthesis or footnote. It is this: that the space which seems to surround us and contain us as embodied entities and all the objects which we call mountains, valleys, lakes, oceans, rivers, houses, cities, vehicles, worlds, stars, galaxies, all whatsoever that we call objects before consciousness in the perceptual sense, but not that appear before our conceptual cognition as the ideas and thoughts in conceptual form. Now the space, as we ordinarily conceive it, seems to be a vast emptiness, which is a universal container of the perceptual objects. Not so exactly of the conceptual ideas. But it dawned on me that it is precisely the function of consciousness to contain the objects. No object exists for us unless it is known. Now it is true that we have the very common habit of thinking of things as existing in space, whether we are conscious of it or not. But that is only a habit. If we're really rigorous in our thinking, we will see that we have no right whatsoever to predicate existence of anything which is not somewhere abiding in consciousness. That habit of predicating the existence of things in space apart from consciousness stands upon no stronger footing than predicating an extra cosmic God as the cause of the events which we experience but do not understand. It is simply, essentially, a false predication. We do not really know any existence whatsoever, save it abides in consciousness in some sense. Therefore, the great container of all objects, perceptual, conceptual, or otherwise, if there is any other way of cognizing them, the great container is consciousness. Therefore, the assumed space of our ordinary point of view conceived as something empty that is the universal container of existences, is actually performing the same function which clear analysis shows to be performed by consciousness itself. This being so, it dawned upon me that the seemingly empty space in which the worlds and stars seem to abide is nothing more than a projection in the psychological sense of the true space, which is nothing other than pure consciousness itself. Consciousness conceived as not dependent upon the presence of either objects or a knower, that the knower and the known are derivative, but the consciousness is original. Our ordinary space is thus only a projection and not a reality in itself. The true space or container, perhaps that which is meant by Akasha, is the primordial, unmade, uncreated consciousness. And this helps to explain many things. It causes my thought to go back to what was called a hitherto unpublished discourse of the Buddha, in which he said to his disciples, "There are three things that are eternally real, and these are nirvana, the law, and space, or akasha. And these three are reducible to one, namely, to space or akasha, which now we must conceive of as a pure, primordial, uncreated consciousness, which pre-exists all objects and all selves, that this is the one ultimate, unmade, eternal reality." Here I would like to draw your attention to the first sloka of the first stanza in the Secret Doctrine. It runs as follows: "The eternal parent, wrapped in her ever invisible robes, had slumbered once again for seven eternities." And the first part of the commentary is as follows: "The parent space is the eternal, ever-present cause of all, the incomprehensible deity whose invisible robes are the mystic root of all matter and of the universe. Space is the one eternal thing that we can most easily imagine. Immovable in its abstraction and uninfluenced by either the presence or absence in it of an objective universe. It is without dimension in every sense and self-existent. Spirit is the first differentiation from that, the causeless cause of both spirit and matter. End of the quotation. Here then, if for space we substitute the conception of a pure, undifferentiated consciousness or consciousness substance, as I have suggested elsewhere, the same thing can be said in terms which are more psychologically understandable. Consciousness is, thus, the true space, the space behind our objective space. And from that, there is differentiated, as it says in the commentary, both spirit and matter. But here, interpret spirit as the knowing subject and matter as the object before consciousness. And we have an understanding of this commentary, which I think comes more clearly within our grasp.